Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. I'm Don Marsh. Before we begin our scheduled segment this hour, an update on the latest in Ferguson. As you have no doubt heard, two police officers, one from St. Louis County, the other from Webster Groves, were shot and wounded during an overnight demonstration outside the Ferguson Police Department. Both are undergoing treatment for non-life-threatening wounds. St. Louis County Police Chief John Belmar held a news conference this morning. St. Louis Public Radio's Tim Lloyd covered that conference, and he joins us in studio. Tim, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me, as always.
What's the headline out of the morning news conference?
Well, I'm going to split it. I think it's a double headline. I think, one, the first part is it's sort of remarkable that this hasn't happened before. Anyone who's been out and covered these demonstrations knows that they are, the vast majority of protesters are peaceful, but it's not unusual to hear gunfire near some of the demonstrations, especially in August and this past November. So I think it's sort of a, part of the headline is it's a miracle this hasn't happened before. The other part is police are reconsidering their tactics now as far as security near demonstrations. Chief John Belmar of the St. Louis County Police said he's going to put more police officers outside the Ferguson Police Department this evening.
Any indication at all as to closing in on a possible suspect? Sorry.
Sure, it's a good question. We don't know exactly what police are doing, but we know that there is some sort of a tactical operation taking place right now near the Ferguson Police Department at a home. We don't know what they're looking for. We know that there are SWAT teams there. We know that there looks like a bomb squad team there, but we don't know exactly what they're looking for. Chief Belmar hedged quite a bit when asked about what are they looking for in their suspect.
It clearly is a priority for the county police department at this point, finding that person.
Oh, without a question. And they think it was a handgun was used, although it's not really clear. The shot came from about, according to Belmar, from about 100 to 150 yards away.
And the shot, as I understand it from one of Rachel's reports, was fired over the crowd, the small crowd of demonstrators that were there.
Well, that's what we're hearing right now. But again, it's an ongoing investigation, so there's a lot of questions that need to be answered. But that certainly seems to be the case.
Well, I also had heard earlier in the day that there was a suggestion that perhaps shots were fired in the air and just somehow misdirected. Is there any indication that anything like that was going on?
Well, I suppose anything is possible. But again, referring back to the official investigation, none of those details have been confirmed. So I would just be cautious on those kind of facts.
Okay. Well, something is going on now with regard to looking for a potential suspect, and we'll just have to wait and see.
Right. And we should also mention both of the officers have been released from the hospital, but we don't know exactly what their recovery will entail. But we do know that they've both been released.
And their wounds, once again, non-life-threatening, obviously, if they've
been
released. Where were they hit?
One was shot in the cheek, and the bullet, according to Chief Belmar, is still lodged somewhere in the man's skull. And the other officer was shot in the shoulder area, and the bullet exited near the base of his spine.
Wow. A matter of inches.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Tim Lloyd, thank you so much for being with us and bringing us up to speed on the Chief Belmar news conference this morning.
Thanks for having me.
Good to talk to you.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks once again to Tim Lloyd for being with us. Now on to a discussion about one of the most important moments in the 20th century civil rights movement, that Bloody Sunday confrontation between civil rights marchers in Selma, Alabama, at the Edmund Pettus Bridge. It was commemorated during ceremonies this past weekend. Several members of the Vatterott family of St. Louis were there to mark the occasion and to honor family patriarch Charles Vatterott Jr. Three members of the Vatterott family are with me in studio to talk about the trip and the reason for it. They are Charles V's daughter, Claire Vatterott Hundelt, his son-in-law, Jerry Holden, who was in Selma in 1965, and Jim Cockland, the patriarch's grandson. Thank you all so much for being with us. Nice to have you here. Claire, let me start with you. Can we have a brief background on the reason for your father's trip to Selma in 65?
He was asked to assist in bringing religious women and men in the march within days after Bloody Sunday. And he was a man who had lived his whole life for civil rights. And it was in his value to do this. So he was given just a few hours to pull it together, and they chartered a plane, and within 4 days they were marching in Selma after Bloody Sunday.
What was the family thinking when he was taking off after that awful weekend?
I think there was concern, I think that it was very quick and not a lot of time to be worried. I think there was challenges when he got back, but I believe that it was not unlike in our family that when something is happening with such a glaring injustice that you don't stand by, you stand up. And it was common for him to do this.
Yeah, he did have quite a record throughout his life in this area. Jerry Holden, let me turn to you. You were there. You were there with Charles Vaderot, correct?
Yes.
Tell me about that experience.
Well, just to answer a question about the plane, it was largely religious people, priests and nuns, along with some lay people. I don't think anybody was afraid, but I think we were apprehensive because we didn't know what to expect. We arrived in motorcade met us and brought us into Selma. It was, I think everybody was apprehensive initially. We were met with some Edmonite priests who have a facility there. It's hard to explain, Don. I just had the feeling that we should be there, that it was important. My father-in-law thought it was very important, and I know I believe Cardinal Ritter was the one who helped put this together for him. But everybody was very serious. Everybody was good-natured. There was a lot of talk. We met with a variety of people. I think in Selma, both blacks and whites who were sympathetic to the cause.
A lot of people in that community were not sympathetic to the cause, I know. Did you have any traffic at all with any of them?
No, we really didn't. There were a couple occasions in crossing a street, with the light green, where maybe a pickup truck with the rifle across the back would inch you forward a little bit, but nothing threatening, more of a warning, let's put it that way.
You were not there for this most recent visit, is that
no,
correct?
No, I was not.
Well, let's turn to someone who was, Jim Coughlin, Charles's grandson. Jim, give me a sense of what that experience meant to you.
Well, it meant a lot, actually. To be in that moment is very powerful. Everyone there was striving for the same pursuit. Firstly, to acknowledge the struggle for equal rights and how far we've come as a people. And also to acknowledge how much more work we have to do in our society.
I'm sure you heard the few moments at the top of this program in which we talked about Ferguson. That would indicate that there's still a way to go, no question about it. Did that come up at all in any conversations you might have had? Ferguson, you're from St. Louis. Ferguson, they're kind of synonymous these days.
Well, we were actually holding signs that said we were from St. Louis and St. Louis, and there were actually many folks from St. Louis that we saw while marching. But no, not with me. There wasn't any conversations about the most recent events in Ferguson.
Let me turn to Claire. Claire, your sense of the experience, what it meant to you and your impression of what was going on.
It was reaffirming, I believe, of people who care. We were, I would say, Jim, a minority in the crowd. There were thousands of people there, but everyone was so focused on the advancements that have been made. And it was exhilarating. We met a lot of amazing people. And Don, when you're in line for 3 hours to see the president, you get to speak to people around you. And we met amazing people. One in particular who was a march in all three marches. He was a foot soldier, made it all the way the 50 miles to Montgomery. And, he's there with such heartfelt passion for what has been accomplished, but also very much aware of what still needs to happen. It was very positive. The people were so friendly. We met amazing people.
What about the sense of history, being in a place like that, at a time like that?
That's an excellent question, because I think when John Lewis spoke and was introducing the president, there hardly was a dry eye, because he said something to the effect that If someone would have told me 50 years ago that I would be back on this bridge presenting the President of the United States, who happens to be the first African American, he never would have believed it. And you could just feel the emotion. And when President Obama came out, it was powerful.
Powerful, very powerful.
What was your sense of the history of that place, Jim, as you prepared to go down and once there?
Well, yeah. My grandfather, to me, was an inspiration when he went down there. And he stood up for the dignity of all men by his actions and his words. And to walk in his footsteps and to be present in the efforts for interracial social justice was just phenomenal. And there was a very good energy in that crowd.
Right. Were you aware of John Lewis and John Lewis's role in that before you were there?
Yeah, I was not aware, actually. Right. But it was wonderful to hear about him.
Yeah. There was some, let me turn to you, Jerry, because I heard something on one of the television programs last night about the idea of changing the name of the Edmund Pettus Bridge to the John Lewis Bridge. Not everybody knows who Edmund Pettus was. He was not, a very likable guy by today's standards. He was a member of the Klan, and yet his name is still on that bridge. What do you think?
Oh, I'd be in favor of changing it. I really don't know anything about him except he was a Klan member, and I thought, well, somewhere along the line, something's going to have to give. I mean, the feeling of commitment to the people who were there, including people, who live in Selma and the environs there. They're committed to a racial freedom and racial equality. And to have the bridge, it's like, having a weight around your foot when you're wading in river.
I think it's more like having a finger stuck in your eye. But that's
that's probably a better example. But I think, I don't know whether there is a movement to change it or not, but it certainly would be worth it.
I think there will be, because this has now become part of the discussion of following the weekend. Claire, do you have any thoughts about that?
Oh, I think it might be a great move towards healing that this country can benefit from. It is a new day, but every leader that spoke, every African-American leader spoke, made it very clear up front to never forget the advancements we've made. It was very important from the mayor of Selma to John Lewis to Clarence Jones, who was Martin Luther King's personal lawyer and personally snuck the letters of Birmingham jail out from the jail, who was eating dinner with us the night before, as well as the Obama speech. It was very important for people today to remember that things have changed for good. We still have work to do. But that was a very consistent message.
Right. I have to take a break. We'll end this segment on that point, but come back and talk more about the Vatterott family visit to Selma, Alabama this past weekend and in 1965 for Bloody Sunday, if you will, and the events that followed that. Claire Vatterott Hundel is with me in studio. Jerry Holden also here, and Jim Coughlin, who is Charles Vatterott's grandson. He was the one that organized that first trip in 65. Back to continue our conversation. If you'd like to get into it, we'd love to have you. Give us a call at 382-8255. That's 382-TALK. You can send us an email to talk@stlpublicradio.org. If you'd prefer to send a tweet, do so at STL on Air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Welcome back as we continue our conversation with members of the Vatterott family. Members of that family were in Selma in 1965, commemorating the march at the Edmund Pettus Bridge during that civil rights demonstration in 1965. Members of the family were also back this past weekend to commemorate the anniversary. Claire Hundel Vatterott is with me in studio. Jerry Holden also with me, as is Jim Coughlin, all members of the Vatterott family. Claire, I don't think I put this question to you with regard to Ferguson. You said a moment ago that we have a long way to go, and we've been hearing ever since about Ferguson. Did that come up in any conversations you had in Selma?
Yes, it did. It came up in conversations. In reflections, we talked as a family about what this meant to us, how we from St. Louis sort of represent Ferguson, but yet we were there. And I think there was something profound about the message of nonviolence that was so disciplined and organized in 1965. And civil disobedience because laws that were unjust. And that resonates. But the nonviolence and the faith-based direction from which that happened, there are still issues that need to be discussed and understood. There are still racial biases. You know, the old saying that if you have prejudice and power, you've got racism. What are we willing to give up in order to make this fair for everybody? Those conversations were had.
I want to talk about the faith component to both your visit and your father's visit. But, Jerry, just curious as to your watching events over the weekend on the television, I assume you were watching, what was going through your mind 50 years later?
That things were better now than they were then. I felt that there was a more profound commitment to change with this group, and I was astounded with the number of young people. a lot of young people there. There were very few young people, 50 years ago. Of course, I was a little younger then too, but not these ages.
The trees were smaller too, right?
Yeah. I just felt that the commitment was stronger, that it was more universally accepted, that more and more people were aware and committed to racial justice, and found racism just as repugnant. And
let me get Jim's. Everybody calls him Jimmy. May I do?
Yeah,
do that?
Of course.
Jimmy, get your sense of that. I mean, your sense of being there with a lot of young people.
Yeah, there were a lot of young people there. It was powerful. Again, there is injustice still. There's still more work to be done, but it has gotten better. So that is apparent to me.
We have a number of people who want to get into this conversation. Let's start that process. And we'll begin with David is calling. We sort of expected this call. David, what is your story?
My story is I went down to Selma with Mike Brown Sr., his family, and a group that was sponsored by the Leadership Coalition for Justice. My experience down there was one of togetherness. Like I heard somebody just say that we have a lot of work to do. There's a long road ahead of us. There definitely is. But like the first time when the elders and everybody went down there, there was a bunch of black folks that wanted to show that, you know, black people were equal. They needed the right to vote. And they had got tired. They were fed up with the way that things were going. Now, you know, you have Ferguson and the young people. And the young people are tired of working for the government. The young people are tired of being mistreated or feeling like they're being mistreated by the government. So we have a lot of laws to change and things of that nature. But down in Selma, as opposed to my experience being sometimes, you know, elders like to talk at you instead of talking with you and, you know, showing you things. While we were down there, every brother, sister, no matter what color that was around for the first time, they were receptive to the things that we were doing, and we were able to get some knowledge and, you know, a little bit more discipline for the road ahead and the things that we have to do to continue carrying this torch. Because obviously there wasn't enough done in between the time from then to now. And if we can continue this spirit of togetherness, not just, you know, black people, white folks, all of that, because everybody has to remember that there are people of every race and color putting their lives on the line to get justice for us now.
David, in case folks missed it at the top of what you said, you went down there with Michael Brown Sr. Of course, that's the Michael Brown that we have been talking so much and hearing so much about since the 9th of August, correct?
Yes, sir, correct.
And how was Michael Brown Sr. received?
Oh, he was received the way that you would expect him to be. People coming up, giving T-shirts, showing love, having a lot of respect for Ferguson, St. Louis, the struggle that we have going on, and also, you know, respect for just him and his family being down there trying to not necessarily enjoy, but experience the same things that everybody else was, you know. So that was very beautiful. We appreciate the people assessed. Of course, there were a couple bumps in the road. No need to really, you know, speak on that too much. You're going to have some people that don't support what you do, no matter where you go, no matter what it is. But everybody that I experienced was positive. So, you know, I enjoyed it. I know we were able to take some people from Ferguson and St. Louis that hadn't even left St. Louis, much less being able to leave and be a part of history. Because, you know, the first time, I don't know what the people that were involved expected. I don't know if they knew that they were going down in history or that we would be going back 50 years later. But this time, we know that 50 years later, you know, there will be more people going down there and we'll be the ones to exchange our stories. And we'll be able to tell our children how we got the name of that bridge changed.
All right.
A lot more.
David, thank you for that, and thank you for the call. Let's find out from someone who was there after the actual Bloody Sunday event, just a day or two after. Jerry Holden here. Did you have any sense of history in the making at that time?
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I think everybody there did, Don. I could never predict that 50 years later occurred what occurred, but we knew that this was the start of something in Selma, and that it was broader than just Selma, that it had a national significance. And I think everyone was committed to seeing, to energizing, you know, this effort, this striving for justice and equality.
We have a number of calls related to the possible renaming of the bridge. Let me take one or two, and we can continue our conversation. We'll start with Bob calling from Edwardsville. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. Concerning the naming of the bridge, given the historic significance of it, I would suggest perhaps naming the bridge after the KK guy as well as Mr. Lewis, and perhaps explain their story and times as a measure of how far we have come, but also another measure as to how far we need to go in the future.
Bob,
keep both stories for history.
Bob, interesting idea. Let me just see what the folks here think about that. Claire, do you have any thoughts on that suggestion?
Well, I think John Lewis is quite a remarkable person, and he stands for so much. Some people were referring to the bridge as Independence Bridge. I heard one of the speakers before President Obama refer to it as Independence Bridge. So I know there's talk about changing it, and maybe it's a good thing.
All righty. Well, we thank Bob for that call. I guess Jack and Alton will join us now. And one more thought about the bridge, then we'll move on. Go ahead, Jack.
Okay. I was over at in Selma. I drove down, and I happened to be a Catholic priest. And I went down with a Jewish community, and we gathered at the temple there, and what I experienced was a sense of solidarity and a renewing of the mission and the vision of racial equality within all of our country, and at this time we surely need it. I also concur with all of what the people have said. The number of young people was astronomical. People were respectful of one another. There was a spirit of joy and camaraderie, and yet when I got down to the bridge, I bowed down and touched that bridge because I know that blood ran on that bridge 50 years ago. So I was filled with many different emotions.
Jack, thank you so much for the call. Did you find a variety of emotions, Claire?
Oh, a lot of emotions. I grabbed onto my son, Kevin Hundelt, and wanted to walk across the bridge with him, and we all felt that way. We wanted just to actually hold on to each other and strangers. There was such a solidarity.
How about the emotion, and Jimmy, on your part?
Yeah, definitely. It felt like I was reliving history, you know, one step at a time, and there was a camaraderie and solidarity in it.
We're kind of bouncing back and forth between what happened this past weekend and what happened 50 years ago. Jerry, I want to come back to you to tell us the story about the suitcase full of money that Charles took with him when he went to Selma in 1965. He carried a load of cash, didn't he?
Yes. Now, I discovered after we were back in St. Louis, yes, he had $25,000 in that briefcase to pay for any questions about incarceration or freedom and whatnot.
It's a post-bond, I think, is what we want to say.
Well, that's what I, thank you.
if it were necessary.
To post-bond, if necessary. I didn't know anything. I didn't know he had the money in there. I knew he had a thing that he never let go, but I didn't know there was money in it.
Claire, I guess you didn't get your allowance
No, I didn't think so. Well, he didn't need it. Mm. It was, I think he wanted to make sure that the sisters didn't spend a night in jail.
Yeah, that was...
Maybe the priests they could manage, but the sisters he didn't. And that sort of brings up the other really important point.
Yeah, I want to get to that.
Is that the sisters in Selma were not allowed to march. Bishop Tulin was a bit of a racist, as I understand, and he would not let the religious be active, but Cardinal Ritter did. And when he was called, and some say from my family and the sisters have said that it was Martin Luther King who called after Bloody Sunday and asked all the people of religion to come and stand with him, that he opened the doors by calling his friend who lived next door, Charlie Vaderot, to say, we need to get this happening. And I think the religious were, especially the women religious in their cleric garb, sent a powerful message. Andrew Young, former mayor of Atlanta and U.S. ambassador, was visiting in St. Louis out at Cedar Creek in the early 80s. And my brother John asked him, because he was attending the International Interracial Peace and Justice Conference, and he said, why are you here? He says, if it wasn't for the women and men religious, we may not have won the civil rights movement.
And they were helpful to you when you went down this
and
last time.
And the Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet in particular made it possible. We just decided to go down there 3 weeks prior, and they found housing for us in people's homes in Selma.
And just by way of historical fact, I believe it was Cardinal Ritter who integrated the Catholic schools
here
in St. Louis just at about this time.
Yes, he did.
All right. Let's take another phone call while we're on the subject of religion. I think we have a Catholic priest with us, perhaps. Tom in St. Louis, go ahead. I'm sorry, I misunderstood. Tom, I think you're going to talk about a Catholic priest. Go ahead.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, my question was, I was wondering if anybody on the panel are... could tell me if Father Thomas Durkin was with the delegation that went from St. Louis.
Was that Durkin?
Yeah.
Yes, he was. Father Durkin, Monsignor Durkin, was with us 50 years ago.
Okay, that's what I want to know, because my mom named me after him.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, so I just wanted to know if he was on the panel, because I'm trying to find out more about him.
Ah.
I mean, if he was on the delegation, that's what I mean.
Any idea where he might be able to find out more? But I would think the Archdiocese would probably have.
The Archdiocese would. And, of course, I can't remember the name of the church on the corner of...
It's Mary Magdalene.
Mary, that's it. Yeah. You know, they have the playground and whatnot is named after Durkin. I would imagine there are people in that parish that know quite a bit about him.
Yeah, I would think so, too. I just haven't gotten over there to ask him, but I just was curious.
Yeah, I think they'd be welcome. You'd be welcome. You know.
Thanks. I appreciate the info.
Thanks so much, Tom, for the call. Let's take another quick one here. We'll bring in Scott calling from Chesterfield. Go ahead, Scott.
Yeah, I want to say that I think that the shooting or the injuring of the two police officers last night, I think it helps the cause of bigotry. But also, I think the fact that, I see a lot of young white people at a lot of these protests, and I think that hurts the cause of bigotry, So
just explain quickly. We're running out of time, but I'm not quite sure I'm following you here.
Well, the fact that whites and blacks are uniting, at least young ones, to protest against police brutality.
I see. Okay.
Yeah.
I don't see how that's helping the cause of bigotry. I think...
That's hurting the cause of bigotry.
Yeah, right.
But
okay.
Shooting the two police officers helps the cause of bigotry.
Right. Okay. Got it. Thanks so much for the call. Any thoughts on that part of it, folks here in the studio? Let's go back. As time begins to get away from us here, I kind of want to get a sense of what your final thought is, Claire, as you think back on both your father and what happened this past weekend.
I think 50 years ago, my dad was called to take a stand. It was uncomfortable, but he did it because he believed in it. And I think that meant a lot to Martin Luther King and all others who wanted this type of support. And it was important to get off the bench, make a stand.
Right. which is exactly what happened. And Jerry Holden, let me, same to you, as you reflect and think about past and present.
Well, we've come, I think, a long way, but I think we have an awful long way to go yet. And I think it's going to depend on just individuals' feelings that something has to change. And the more we can encourage that, whether it's through religion or politics or whatever, I think we need to, I don't think that, we don't have 50 years worth of change in the past 50 years. I think we need more in this next 50 or next 20 or next year, more energy.
Very quickly, do you think that the Ferguson story is an instrument of that change?
Boy, that's a tough one. You mean the whole Ferguson, not just today?
Exactly. Yeah. What's happened since the Michael Brown shooting?
I think it has. There's been some terribly destructive behavior too that didn't add anything positive to it. But I think overall it had a good effect.
Yeah. And Jimmy, we'll end with you. What is your final thought about what we've been talking about?
Well, on to the Ferguson. I think the recent events were, at least in the young generation, a reaction to perceived police brutality. So that's important to acknowledge. And there's, like my uncle said, there has to be socioeconomic changes still yet to be completed in this society.
We'll see where it takes us. I want to thank you. Jimmy Cochran,
thank you for being with us.
Jerry
Holden,
thank you. Claire Vatterott-Hundle, thank you so much for being with us. When we come back, connecting the dots between African-American thinking in the last century and in this one. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU.